Sean, where to begin? I've been so overwhelmed by this book, and congratulations on this stunning achievement.
Brian, thank you so much.
Take us back to the beginning when, I guess, Thomas Edison played a role in Edward Easton's company. This is 1880s or so?
Edison invented the phonograph in the 1870s, but then backed away from it, and others came into the field, invented other kinds of phonographs. And then Edward Easton was a guy who was involved in a company, he was actually a stenographer, got involved in a company that was going to market a particular one of those machines, the graphophone. They had the franchise for Maryland and Washington, D.C., and I think part of Virginia, Delaware too maybe. And anyway, they were going to sell this machine, but they had the idea of actually taking the cylinders that were then being used, and mostly for dictation in offices, but to actually put music on them, and then to try to sell them to amusement vendors and to private consumers, and not just to be selling the machines, to be selling the cylinders too, with the music attached to them. Columbia was the first actually to come up with that idea. They started in 1889, and the rest is history.
Well, the list of recording artists affixed to the label, to Columbia Records, as well as a lot of their producers, just phenomenal. People like, back in the early days, Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong, Al Jolson, through the Sinatra, Tony Bennett, Barbara Streisand area, Benny Goodman, Count Basie,
right,
Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan. And I want to stop for a moment there because I found it very interesting. A lot of people know of a relationship with Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan, but Johnny Cash, back in the Columbia Records days, was really a big champion for Bob Dylan when Columbia wasn't all that excited about him at one point.
Bob Dylan's first album bombed. I mean, it didn't do well at all, and it didn't really fit in very well with Columbia's list, which was then people like Johnny Mathis and Tony Bennett and so forth. Barbara Streisand was a better fit. So Dylan comes in, his first record bombs, but Cash was among those who had real weight at the label who said, no, stick with this guy. His producer, John Hammond, and one of the legends you talked about before, was certainly the most important character in keeping Columbia attached to Dylan. But Johnny Cash helped. And Johnny Cash, whenever he's in New York, he'd look Dylan up. He'd go over to the studio and hang out with him there. Made it clear that he thought this young man was a very talented songwriter. And then they became closer and closer. He also defended them when people thought that Dylan was getting a little too personal in his songs, was moving off the political stuff. Not in Columbia so much as outside of Columbia. And Johnny Cash was his great defender. So there was a kind of mentor-mentee aspect to all of that in the Cash-Dylan relationship.
Now, at one point, and I can't think how long ago this was, a decade, maybe 15 years ago, didn't Columbia drop Johnny Cash after a long, long, long contract?
Yeah, they did. Few people last forever. There are many who did. Dylan, Streisand, Tony Bennett, and so forth. But no, I mean, Cash left the label, went elsewhere, did some amazing recordings outside of Columbia. So you can't say that Columbia is the only fountain of musical genius. That's certainly not the case. And Rick Rubin and the American recordings that Cash did toward the end of his life are really quite extraordinary. They did, however, sign an artist who was in the book, who I mentioned, named Roseanne Cash.
Mm-hmm.
And she stayed with the label for a while and recorded some of her best early music with Columbia. So there was a certain family affair to all of that as far as the Cash family was concerned.
And Bob Dylan still does have a long, long run, although at one period, and I can't think of it, was the album Planet Waves, he went to Geffen for one record.
He may have been two. I can't remember.
No, it was just the one record. But what were the circumstances there on him leaving?
In Live 74, I can't remember if that was on Geffen or on Columbia. Anyway, it's all on Columbia now, that's for sure. Artists get restless. Artists can be seduced, as it were. And they did the Planet Waves album on Geffen. But then Dylan got dissatisfied with the way the distribution was going on. He thought that Columbia would do a better job. And then there had been a change of the guard at Columbia as well. And the interim guy, Orman Siegelstein, made it his business to court Bob Dylan back onto the Columbia label, which he did.
Another big, big name associated usually with Atlanta Records, although I only became aware of it probably within the past 5 to 10 years. Aretha Franklin's early, early recordings, 59, yeah. 60.
That's right.
It's been re-released anyway on a collection called Unforgettable, and some phenomenal things she did back then.
She did really great, great stuff. The problem was twofold with Aretha. First, she didn't get along that well with John Hammond. I mean, unlike Dylan, who was his boy, Hammond's Folly, they called him. Aretha and he didn't, it was not a match made in heaven. Secondly, Columbia really didn't know what to do with her. They were not an R&B label by any means. They had no sense of her as that kind of singer. They were a gospel label. They had recorded Mahalia Jackson, for example, but they saw her as more of a pop singer, but they didn't know what to do with her. So they tried her out doing Dinah Washington jazz kind of things. They had her doing girl group kinds of things, and none of it quite gelled. She had made some hits. She had done very well. What a voice, right? You can't help it. But her style still needed to be honed down. It was only when she left Columbia for Atlantic and got hooked up with Jerry Wexler. And Wexler was the one who understood that you could take that gospel roots that she had out of Detroit in her father's church how you could take that and, as he said, secularize it, turn it into songs about love and defiance and respect, and that's Aretha Franklin.
Boy, did Jerry Wexler ever understand that.
Yeah. As I say, Columbia is not the fount of all wisdom.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how many people actually pass through Columbia, at least for a brief period of time.
It really is. On the flip side of the coin, some of the artists that Columbia wanted but couldn't get, can you name any of those?
It's not so much that they wanted them, they let them go. I mean, they could have signed Elvis Presley. They could have signed Buddy Holly. But they decided at that time rock and roll was not really something they wanted to get involved in for commercial reasons and artistic reasons. Mitch Miller, do you remember Mitch Miller from the Gang?
Oh, yeah.
Sing Along with Mitch. He was the head of A&R Columbia, and he was not a rock and roll guy by any means. So those acts went elsewhere. Elvis is one of the ones that didn't sign with Columbia, although all those things now end up with Sony because RCA Victor got folded into Sony. So in the end, he's something of a Sony recording artist. But yeah, I mean, Columbia made all sorts of bad decisions. It didn't get into hip-hop. Well, none of them got into hip-hop till late, but
yeah.
Not until the mid-'80s when Rick Rubin was starting Def Jam Records and they hooked up originally with Def Jam did they get interested in hip-hop. So Columbia doesn't have a perfect record by any means. The thing about Columbia is once it jumps in, it's in for a penny, in for a pound. And so they became the great rock label in the late 60s, early 1970s, the premier rock label in the world. Hip-hop is not quite as much, but it's a different kind of field. But it still has the Fugees, and it has Nas, and it has any number of really important acts.
Visiting with Sean Wilentz. Sean's the author of a terrific book called 360 Sound, The Columbia Records Story. Sean, we're in Cincinnati here, a couple of Cincinnati connections. Andy Williams, one of the Columbia
yep.
artists from way back when. And also in 1917, the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra recorded for Columbia. They were the third U.S. orchestra in the U.S. to record music, and they were on Columbia initially.
That's right. And Columbia was very active, actually, early on. I mean, classical music was the heart of the field early on. I mean, there were these novelty acts, pop music, and so forth. But Columbia's great rival, Victor Records, had Enrico Caruso. They had the best of classical music. Columbia did what it could to keep up, and a lot of its work was in recording great American orchestras like the Cincinnati.
The state of the industry today, we're told, suffers from downloads. The record industry, I'm talking about iTunes, iPods,
yep.
and Pandoras,
yep.
and the other both legit and illegitimate music sources. What kind of shape is Columbia Records in today?
Well, it's tough. They have to adapt. They did a terrible job of trying to adapt in the first part of the 2000s, taking Napster to court. Dumb idea, right? You're alienating not just the download company, and you're alienating your own customers, right, who are downloading away. So they've had to adapt to the digital era. They've had to make their own way in that new era. They're doing their best by coming up with new business models along the lines of Glee, for example. I mean, involved in TV and also with the Simon Cowell stuff. I mean, being involved in all of the America's Got Talent, Britain's Got Talent, all of those shows, seeing those as sources for music and for recorded music in new ways, but also remaining a traditional label in some ways, in that they sign the artists who they think will be the important artists, and people are drawn to that label. So that, for example, artists as different as Adele, who was had an independent contract in Britain, and then Columbia bought her contract for America and for South America, she's a Columbia recording artist. Jack White, who was about as militantly independent rock and roller as you can imagine, he got Wanted Man Records, his company in Nashville, hooked up with Columbia. And why? It had to do with the fact that Columbia still had commercial muscle, and still get the music bought. It can still advertise. And it had that aura. It was Bob Dylan's label. He wanted to make it his label. So there we are.
I can't say enough good about this book. It is my favorite book of the day, and I'm going to cherish it. And thank you so much, Sean.
Thank you so much.
Been speaking with Sean Wilentz. 360 Sound, The Columbia Record Story is the beautiful book. I'm Brian O'Donnell for Around Cincinnati.
The days of wine. Laugh and run away like a child at play through a meadowland toward a closing door, a door marked nevermore that wasn't there before.